Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Following On podcast. I'm John Norman, and for the next hour, we'll be bringing you an exclusive interview with an Essex great. Ryan Tendoscata speaks with our very own Neil Manthorpe to look back at a career in the game, his astonishing numbers associated with it, and playing into his 40s. So much to come over the next hour. You're listening to Following On.
There was a time, quite a long time actually, when Ryan Tendoscata was routinely described as underrated or even underappreciated, but those days are long gone, especially in Chelmsford and amongst Essex people, to whom the man is now a legend. County Championship winners and now Bob Willis Trophy winners, with Tendo, as always, in the thick of the action in the final against Somerset at Lord's. We'll talk about that, his international career, his aspirations for the future, and a lot more besides in the next hour. So welcome, Tendo, and thanks for your time.
Cheers, man. As always, nice to talk to you and nice to be chatting a bit of cricket at the end of the summer.
And what a summer it's been.
Essex, once again, have done it. They've won the Bob Willis Trophy.
The Bob Willis Trophy produced some intense cricket. I mean, at one stage, you must have wondered whether you'd actually play any. What are your reflections on the summer now?
That's a good point to start with. I think, it's a bit of a throwaway line to say how brilliant everyone was for putting the cricket on. But hand on heart, standing at the prize giving there at Lord's, the first or the most overwhelming feeling was, well done everyone, well done the ECB, well done the individual counties for getting through that group stage and putting the final on in what's been a very tough year for cricket. So, it's not just a throwaway line. I did think it was a great effort to have the whole tournament and the way it was played and the way it played out was very good as well. Obviously, winning it, fantastic. Defending champions from last year. There wasn't much to play for this year. There were the 10 T20 games and the 5 rounds of the Bob Willis Trophy. So we set our stall out at the start when we knew what the format was going to be to win it. We knew we had to be clinical. And again, that reward of going through a sustained period of time with virtually no slip-ups is a nice feeling to get the job done again.
I think over 1 million people watched the final. It was an intense game, really terrific atmosphere. And obviously the county championship doesn't have a final. Everything seemed to go according to plan, except perhaps for the celebrations afterwards.
Yes. Those things are actually linked, because when you in the change room afterwards celebrating, there's not even, your own media, social media guys aren't there. It's literally the 15 of you that played plus the coaches. And maybe we just got sidetracked a little bit by being a bit careless, by not being aware of the situation. We got called onto the balcony and there were a handful of photographers there. It's something we regret, but at the same time, I know how the team's feeling is, A, towards Feroz himself. He's a valued member of the team, is a much loved member of the team, a young guy. And B, to the general sensitivity and awareness of guys, to our cultural responsibilities and, religious responsibilities in a sense. So, unfortunately, that got shown up and maybe blown out of proportion. But I always like to use an accounting term, substance over form. If you're maliciously throwing beer over someone or you're trying to be disruptive, I think that's a very different matter to maybe just forgetting your surroundings and momentarily for a young guy to make a mistake like that is a small oversight, and I would hate it to mar what was a great season of cricket for everyone.
They've won the Bob Willis Trophy here at Lord's, the 5-day final, They come out on top, drawing the fixture. Champions in 2017, champions in 2019, and they win the Bob Willis Trophy in 2020.
What did the Bob Willis Trophy make you think about the championship? And I've mentioned intensity of cricket a couple of times now. As you said, you pretty much had to win every game. I mean, you had to throw everything at every game for a victory. There was also the enforced declaration at 120 overs. That was interesting. But do you think it has a future? Because there is a movement now towards perhaps turning the county championship into more of a conference type format.
Yeah, those are certainly the murmurings, yeah, and the most likely option for next year. I don't know how much you saw, how much you followed of the whole competition. And the final was very intense. And, you know, us in Somerset have sort of been the form teams for the last 2 or 3 years. And if you look at their lineup, there's quality all the way through. But to be honest, a lot of the group games lack that intensity. I think that's a feather in the cap for the overseas system. Yeah, you know, it's only one or two positions, but taking the overseas player out of each team leaves a massive hole. And probably more topical and more controversial is the Colpack guys who are about to lose their status. So you take a team like Hampshire, they don't have Fidel Edwards and Carl Abbott all of a sudden and no overseas player. They're a very different team. So I'd be careful to draw comparisons between the format and the intensity without forgetting that we've taken, you know, a bulk of the better players out of most teams. So I think you need to judge those two things separately. The intensity was down from previous seasons, but that was only because of those players missing. But certainly a conference style can work, and it certainly allows for even less slip-ups than a county championship season, which is played over 14 games.
Traditionalists are horrified about the idea of less first-class cricket. But then again, they were horrified at the idea of promotion and relegation in two divisions, weren't they?
Yeah, everything takes a bit of time to settle in. But also, my understanding is the conference style wouldn't necessarily mean less cricket. So you'd have your five group games in a seeded conference, and then you'd almost go into a second pool, you know, whether it's the top two teams from the three conferences, then going to a new semi-league. So there's six games there again. Six teams, five games. So if you take five plus five, maybe plus a final, you end up being, my understanding is it'll be around the 14 mark game again if you went all the way.
So you're adopting a wait and see approach, or are you?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we can only deal with what's in front of us. My preference would be the championship style, the old style, two divisions nine teams. So you play your 14 games home and away. That's also a big thing for me. You know, if you're going to conference style and you're only playing everyone once, it makes a big difference if you play Warwickshire at home or you play Warwickshire away. You know, traditionally a very good wicket, one of the few very good wickets left in county cricket. It's hard to get a result there. And that's the nice thing about the home and away format. You have to perform at every venue and against every team, home and away. So out of the two options, I'm certainly in favour of the traditional county format. But in these times, we have to roll with the punches, and whatever's thrown at us, we'll have to adopt in the short term.
Oh, shot. What a shot that is. Full length and flicked away beautifully on the leg side for four.
I remember more clearly than I probably should. Not the actual day, but I remember the moment of the week when I heard that you were going to England for a trial, that you'd been offered a trial. And fair to say, and I'm talking myself down here, but I was probably amongst a number of people who thought that you might be jumping the queue there, that there might be a few other better cricketers than you at that stage. But tell us how that trial came about. I mean, did you foresee that anything like the career that you've had?
Look, I take no offence to the point you make. You know, I was delighted to be given this opportunity. I always knew I had something different about me. I knew I was never technically the best player. You know, I always knew I was a good fielder. I knew I could do small jobs, you know, bits of jobs in each department. And I was also very naive about county cricket. I didn't know much about county cricket. So I think it came more out of the blue to me than anyone else. But having said that, it did come on the back of two very good performances against Essex. So I played in a select 11, a Western Province invitation team, if you want to call it, a very strong team. If I remember, guys like Alan Dawson played, Graham Smith played, I mean, those are two standout names, but it was a composite side of half the professional guys and half the guys who've done well in club cricket. And in the three-day game, I took wickets against them. I bowled nicely at Newlands. And then in the one-day game, I banged it. I came in down the order and I don't remember exactly, but hit in the region of 50 off maybe 20 balls. I also knew that when I arrived at Essex that I was miles off the mark. I did know that. And bizarrely, I bowled very well in my first day of the trial in the second 11, and they put a contract in front of me straight away. And then also knew I had this runway of two and a half years to make something out of myself. And I was very lucky in Graham Gooch taking me under his wing, you know, more from a mentorship role than an actual hands-on cricket role. But he used to take me to the airport early on a Sunday morning so I could fulfill my Dutch commitments. And he'd pick me up then on a Monday again, and I'd stay at his house in between and I'd play my second team cricket. And then in the following year, I moved in with Grant Flower, and that transformed my career. We would spend, on average, I'd say 2.5 hours on the bowling machine, just two of us. He would feed me, and he literally turned me into a batter, you know, remembering that when I got here, I was a bowler. I batted 10, 11 in my first couple of games. And I kind of saw that there was a chance that I could make it at least a county level as a batter. But to answer your original question, no, absolutely. I would never in my wildest dreams have thought that I'd have a 19-year career playing county cricket and all the side bits that I've gone with.
Oh, will he get an overthrow? He does. He might get five. What a way to bring up your first World Cup 100. It's the third in World Cups for a Netherlands batsman, the first for Ryan Tender-Scarter, his first, fourth in one-day internationals.
I don't mean to embarrass you, but you said you regarded yourself as a cricketer who could do a job, and you said bits, and I thought you were going to say bits and pieces. But your numbers, your record is the polar opposite of a bits and pieces cricketer. It is astonishing. And for those who don't realise, you average over 45 in both first-class cricket and ODI cricket, 11,000 first-class runs, 29 hundreds. The list goes, your international numbers we'll come to in a moment because they're even more eye-watering. But you started off as a number 10 batsman. I mean, it's just bizarre. So it was sheer hard work with Grant Flower, who I know is a workaholic.
Absolutely. You know, if I was starting my career now and you asked me what I'd be happy averaging, I'd probably say 30. And I can't describe, I can't explain how I've got those numbers. You know, I've tended to get scores at the right time. I've tended to be, you know, I've never been a 1,200 runs a year man, but I'm always in the 800 mark. And I think over time and also in the position where I'm at with getting a few not outs, those numbers look pretty good. But I've always, and I mean this quite genuinely, I've always seen my role as how can you influence a game? And I think at batting at six or seven, you know, I've batted at six most of my career, five at times. But I think the way you can sway a game and change a game is more important in that position than, you know, what your actual numbers suggest. And I think, to be quite honest, that's quite lucky the numbers have worked out like that. I think if you really scrape the numbers and you've seen how many not outs there are, or you know, how many of those runs have come in the first class runs, I know it's not a bulk of them, but say 1,000 of them have come for the Dutch at 100, you know, that has slightly skewed the numbers. And yeah, I mean, I don't really know how to answer those questions, but I feel like those numbers are very flattering for the cricketer that I am, if that makes sense.
I don't know, but I know a lot of statisticians who would say that the numbers don't lie. Okay, yeah. they might have been given a shine. But here's the thing. When I was doing my research, I spoke to several of your colleagues, and I mentioned those numbers. And a good friend of yours said, he said, runs that matter.
In again, and that's a lovely drive this time.
That is what Tendo does, runs that matter. Never mind the average. He said, if you count just runs that mattered, he'd be averaging 60. Is that? Yeah. Did you find yourself rising to the occasion? I mean, did you enjoy pressure situations?
You're going to laugh, but I've never felt pressure.
We can't call the winner yet, as Ryan Tender-Scarter joins Paul Walter in the middle. Could be set up for a very tense finish here as we head into the final first-class session of the season.
So in the sense that, like, if I'm going out to bat, whether it's, you know, Lords last week where I know we have to save the game, or if I'm playing a club game down the road at Clacton, it all feels the same to me. And Hashim Amla told me when he played at Essex, he spoke about blue skies, and he spoke about if you're wasting energy on worrying, that's sort of shortening the distance between the ball and the bat. And if you're worried about, you know, how you're picking the bat up, it shortens everything. Does that make sense? So I've always, and luckily before I even spoke to Hash, I kind of had this sense that worrying was just useless. And I almost enjoyed facing the chance of not doing well. So I was happy to go, if I was facing Jimmy Anderson at Chelmsford, you know, if he got me out at the good ball, I was happy with that. It didn't bother me. I wasn't afraid of it. You know, if I made a mistake, I wasn't afraid of that either. I could go back and say, right, today you made a mistake. So I just try to keep my attention on doing what I could do well. And I've done that in big games, if you want to call it that as well. So I've also never felt that I need to rise to the occasion or that I play better when crunch time's on. But I think not worrying about it and my background of, you know, that this should never really have happened, this career, I think it's always allowed me to think freely and be carefree in my approach to my profession.
Your average, a statistician tells me, is like 10 runs higher when you come to the wicket with less than 100 runs on the board.
Historically, Ryan Tendiscarter is not a good starter. He's often quite fidgety. He's got very low hands. You often feel as a spinner and men around the bat, you got a chance of a bat pad.
Basically, you know, if the teams you play for have been 50 for 4 or 70 for 5, you are statistically more likely to score big runs than if you come to the crease at 200 for 4. Amazing.
Wow, that is, yeah. I mean, I've always seen myself as a problem solver as well. So I wouldn't say big situations or small situations. But if for instance, I walk in at 80 for 3 and I know we're chasing 270, you know, I can work out 190. And if I get 90 not out, we're winning the game. Or even if I get 60 and I'm the third next batsman out, I know the tail are going to, you know, get the last 40 or 50 together. So I've always enjoyed like the management side of an innings and a chase or even a set. You know, if I have something in front of me, I tend to work out a lot better. So if there's nothing on the game, or if I walk in at 500 for 4, I don't have those same juices flowing that allow me to operate at my best.
Never thought of you as a mathematician batsman, but that's what it is, isn't it? It's, as you said, problem solving. You just sort of break it down into its component parts and do the sums, mm-hmm. and eventually you get there.
Yeah, I think being, I don't want to call myself smart, but I think being able to work out what's required is a big skill of batting or bowling. You know, I don't think you need to have all the tools. I don't think you need to have a straight drive and a late cut and, be able to hit the ball from in front of your face. But I think if you can work things out and sort of give yourself the best chance of getting to that goal, so, you know, which bowlers you attack, which side you go from, how much you trust your partner when you take it on yourself, I think that's a big skill of batting and something that gets overlooked quite a bit.
Oh, what a delivery! That's come from absolutely nowhere. That is brilliant bowling. It's nicked again. Oh, it's brilliant! It's absolutely stunning.
Oh, and he's bowled it. And there's a big inside edge, but it is taken out his leg stump.
We've only been talking about batting now. There's a little matter of 569 wickets across the format. Again, that's an enormous number. I guess one of the things that strikes me is how often you've either chosen to or had to reinvent yourself as a bowler. There's no role you haven't done. I mean, you know, from opening to bowling a few overs as fourth change, you know, a bit of a part time, and then suddenly having to take a frontline role with the ball again. Have they been equally important to you, the two disciplines?
No. So it's one of my big regrets is that I let my bowling slip. I almost had the yips when I came to the UK. You know, I told you I bowled really well on that first day, and then sort of for the next 2 years, I went in and out of not being able to land the ball. And I tried absolutely everything. I'm talking about lying on the indoor school, you know, lying flat and doing sort of like a meditation session with John Childs, with music in the background, and, you know, trying to reset. I then try to bowl off like like trying to land the ball 2 meters in front of me and then work back the other way. And, you know, then 3 meters, then 4 meters. We tried everything. And I always felt like a part-time bowler. And as you've seen towards the back end of my career, bizarrely, I now feel like I can bowl again. Like I'm bowling really well. The ball's coming out nicely and swinging. But I think I threw the towel in a little bit too early on the bowling front. And it's something I actually should have achieved a lot more with the ball. That's my honest opinion.
You had some amazing days out with the ball. But let's move on to international cricket, in which you averaged 67 with the bat in 33 one-day internationals. But before we get into that, just explain your Dutchness and your affinity with the Netherlands, because it's not a passport of convenience as such, is it?
I mean, to a degree it is. My dad was Dutch. You know, we didn't grow up in Dutch surroundings, so to speak.
Well, you were born in Port Elizabeth, right?
Yeah. I mean, my mom's African, my dad's Dutch. My dad came over as a young man, met my mom, and they started a family there. We had very loose contact with the family in Holland, you know, like any children of immigrants who always talked about the windmills and the tulips, blah, blah, blah. And then when I turned 16, my dad thought it'd be a good idea for us to all get passports, and the Dutch cricket board were aware that I had this passport. But I actually think it's a good example of where I was leaving Cape Town as a cricketer, because I had this passport and there was very little appetite, you know, for even the Dutchies to take me on. And I don't mean that disrespectfully, but, you know, the level of associate cricket compared to county cricket, in my opinion, I think generally accepted, is a step down. So they never sort of wanted me to come join the Dutch team, or, you know, they weren't even keen for me to go over and get involved in the system. And then when I signed for Essex, almost immediately I get a message saying, you know, right, you're here now. What do you think of playing for the Dutch team? And, you know, for me, I wanted to do it. I saw it was a great chance to play in these competitions, to play against better players, and to get around the world. And yeah, that's pretty much how it started. But I also had an inkling that, you know, Essex was my heart. Like, I wanted to do really well at Essex and then help the Dutchies where I could. And that didn't always sit well. I mean, rightfully so. You know, if you're offering up a national spot to a player, maybe you do expect the buy-in. But I was always very clear in my head that, you know, that I sort of owed my cricketing career and everything that I've made out of cricket to Essex.
Another statistician's delight, and you are a man they feast on, because you provided such wonderful numbers. So take 30 ODIs as the minimum number. You averaged 67. And then you look at the players underneath you. Next on the list is Virat Kohli with 59.
Virat Kohli makes room. Over mid-wicket. Oh, that's a big one. The biggest six of the night. Well into the second deck.
Also in that list, MS Dhoni, AB de Villiers, Michael Bevan. If somebody shows you that list, how do you feel? Are you embarrassed?
No, you know, I think those guys could be good players. They just need to work a bit harder in between them. I think that's, no, look, I make a joke about it, because every year on my birthday, I get a tweet from ESPN Cricket Info, and it's always the same. You know, the world's highest ODI batting average guy turns 40 today, whatever it is, and you know straight away it's coming. All the fans from Pakistan and India are like, "You're not as good as Baba. You're not as good as Virat." I'm not embarrassed about it, but I'm always keen to make a point about it, that, you know, you can dive into those, you can mine those stats, and the majority of those runs, or a lot of the high scores, have come against Canada and Kenya and Namibia, and unfortunately that is all classed in the same boat. But of course I also know that there's no comparison, and I think anyone who knows anything about cricket, you know, you don't compare those stats. Obviously, the stats are very good, and I've done as much as I could in the cricket that I've been afforded, but I'd certainly laugh at anyone or not take them seriously, you know, who try to draw comparisons between guys who have played vast majority of their game in that setup. You know, the India, Pakistan, Australia, South Africa, West Indies, you know those teams are very different to playing the vast majority of your games against Namibia, Kenya, etc.
It sounds crazy to ask you whether you've got any regrets, because you have had such a wonderful, successful career at Essex, and they've given you a great life. But have you ever wondered about if you'd taken a different international path? I guess you could have played it theoretically for South Africa or England.
Yeah, I could have. And actually, at one stage, I was looking at getting a British passport, but more for the convenience to Essex. There was a rule at the time that English qualified players were subsidized by the ECB. So, you know, it made sense for the payroll to get me on. But bizarrely, I've never felt English, and I made a point of it early on. Not that I was ever close. I'm not saying that. But, you know, I remember with all the uproar when KP turned to play for England, you know, I never felt like that was even an option for me. It might have been different if I was in that class, if I was a Jonathan Trott or a Kevin Peterson. And, you know, I was desperate and I thought I deserved to play international cricket. And I brought myself over to play county cricket. Yeah, then I might have. But me personally, no, I never thought about that. Growing up, you know, I always dreamed of playing for South Africa, of course, like everyone. But again, I think I was pretty switched on in terms of how realistic it was. And I never thought of myself in anywhere near that setup. But I'm pretty sure I can say this. In one of the Champions Trophy or Champions Leagues, the RPL, the winners competition, I done really well. And one of the South African players asked if he could pass my number on to Russell Domingo. And Russell rang me up and said that he was very keen for me to play in the next World Cup. And I kind of read the race. I said, listen, you got a guy who's not played any cricket in South Africa. You know, I would be a nominal selection at best. You know, I might be a utility player. Like, do you think this is the right thing? You know, it's going to meet a lot of resistance, and rightly so. That was my stance. And he kind of said, I'll leave that up to me. It must have been 2015 because I was going to the Big Bash with Adelaide. And, you know, I said, look, he said, okay, one of the things you might have to do is you might have to come play a domestic season back here. I said, I've got this contract with the Strikers, which I'm happy to turn away. It's not about the money. If there's a fair process where, you know, you want me to come play the domestic season, you have a look at me, I would definitely do that. But I suggested that he was going to meet a lot of resistance from the board. And he said, leave it up to me. And I just never heard back from him. I've got no issues with that. And I personally never felt that I was near to being, you know, in that class. At that stage, you would have had David Miller, Ferran Bardeen. You had decent closing batters around in any case. But that's probably as close as it got for me. It was very late in my career. And maybe there was a smidgen of sort of what might have been. But to answer your question, I've never had any regrets. I feel like I've played my cards as best as I could. I've received from the game.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If I said 100 times more than I should have or that I ever thought I would, that would be an understatement. So the things that have fallen in my path through cricket, far exceed anything that I could ever have expected.
Carved out towards cover, man underneath it, can't get there. Six over cover. And he begins with a slower ball, which is hit straight back over his head for six. And that one is driven, swatted down the ground for six. Short, pulled away, six more.
T20 cricket, You've played 369 games. 369 T20s. That's an extraordinary number, including, first of all, that's top 10 of all time. I think it's actually in fifth or sixth place. Quite amazing. Again, you've had to reinvent yourself to do that. I want to talk about that and also about your time in the IPL, because you played in seven domestic leagues, including the IPL with the Kolkata Knight Riders. It's T20 cricket has given you some air miles, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it couldn't have come at a better time for me. You know, when I started my career, coincided with T20 launching. I think it was my first year at Essex was the first T20 competition in England. And, you know, I can't think of a player who it was more suited to at the time. You know, someone very unconventional. You know, I've said before, the euphemism was he hits the ball in strange places, you know, which is great. It was different. And back then, guys didn't used to, you know, sit back and bang it out the park. It was rare to have a strike rate of 150 and to be able to, you know, come in and whack the ball. So it couldn't have worked any better for me. And probably where the bulk of my sort of traction as a cricketer on the biggest stage has come, you know, being in the IPL, having a chance to play in Australia, you know, finishing off at Nelson Mandela Bay Giants last year was, you know, felt like the perfect treat, you know, going back to Port Elizabeth where it all started, where all my dreams started, to play a few games there at the back end of the Mzansi. And yeah, I've thoroughly enjoyed T20 cricket. I liked it more when not everyone was banging it out of the park. But, you know, you rock up now to nets and every trialist plays a sweep against the seamers and plays a reverse sweep against medium paces and, you know, can sit back in the crease and whack a length ball over extra cover. So the game has changed a lot. And I think I was lucky in the sense that my skill set was set up for that, you know, before it was popular and before everyone was doing it.
How do you hit the ball in strange places? Is it... I think it was Hashim Amla, actually, you mentioned it. He said to me, well, you got to learn to hit the ball in the gaps. And it sounded very obvious, but do you know what I mean? It's like, okay, here's my strength. They've blocked it. I now have to hit the next ball to a place that isn't my strength, and I just have to find a way. Was that the thinking, the rationale behind it?
Yeah, it's a little bit of chicken and an egg. So if you, probably the best way to describe it is, if you coach traditionally, you know, if you think about it, your cover drive should go to cover. Your straight drive should go between mid-off and mid-on. Your leg clip goes just behind square leg. If you're not coached traditionally, you know, maybe your leg clip goes in front of square. You know, maybe your late cut goes to in front of point as opposed to the traditional just behind point fielding position. So I think for me, that was a big thing, not having the traditional coaching. And then, you know, without getting too technical or drilling down into things, I'm a massive believer of you're a product of your literal environment where you play cricket as a youngster. So for me, it was a big brick wall sort of 3 meters in front of me as I'm taking stance, which means I never chose to play through the offside because there was a nice big field behind my back all the way to the neighbor's garden at Cow Corner. And you know, that's obviously where I chose to hit. You can see the tennis ball flying and you know, as a 7, 8, 9 year old, that's all you want to see. So I think it's a mixture of those two things. And then, you know, again, as you practice more and that you become good at those strengths and people who have been coached traditionally don't hit those shots. They're better at keeping their elbow up and hitting it between cover and extra cover, etc.
Over number three was a double wicked maiden for Darren Stevens. Trago first to go, and then Hildreth. Yeah! This was a messy reply from Somerset. 18 for four after three overs.
I must confess, I'm obsessed with longevity in professional sport. Anybody who's still playing a physically demanding sport at 40 just fascinates me. Do you fascinate yourself in that regard?
I think if you think about it, it's pretty crazy. I mean, I'm not the only guy doing it. I think Darren Stevens is the best example, you know, because he bowls majority. He's 43 or 44. And if you look 20 years ago, it wasn't abnormal at all. You know, Graham Gooch, these sort of guys play well into their 40s as well. I've always been very lucky genetically. I've never gymmed. So again, coming from that sort of non-professional background where you pack your cricket bag away on the 26th of September and then you pick up a rugby ball and you play that till the 1st of March and you take your cue bag out again. That was sort of my fitness regime. I didn't train my back to be able to bowl and I didn't train my quads to be able to stand in the field all day. So I think I was very lucky in that regard in the sense that my fitness has always been a functional fitness. I love all sports. So I've just told you, I've just come to the squash court now. I'll try and play golf 2-3 times a week. I love a little kick around a football. You know, I play in a five-side team in the winter. But mainly genetically, you know, my teammates always call me Benjamin Button. And I don't feel any you know, more tired or more sore. But mainly mentally, you know, to rock up every day. And sometimes it's not like that I'm embarrassed to be competing against young guys. But sometimes it's like, you know, you're a grown man. Yeah, you sometimes feel like it's a young man's sport. And I think the key for me is to make sure that I keep fighting that and you know, just looking, am I still offering something useful to this team, you know, from a cricketing point of view? And as long as that's still a yes for me, and I'm still enjoying the challenge of going out there and trying to compete with all these young guys, I'll keep going.
So I'm not going to make the schoolboy error of asking you how long you're going to keep going. I got the impression that you were sort of ready and at peace a couple of years ago. You were sort of ready for retirement. It's not something that scared you. So is it true to say that you're just in happy bonus time?
Yeah, I'm very wary of hanging on. I definitely don't want to do that. And, you know, if I've obviously got a contract for another year. But if Essex came to me in March and said, listen, mate, you've had a tough winter and, you know, you're not really long in our plans. No, I'm not going to hang on for the rest of the summer and take a salary. I'm not scared of stopping. I want to make sure I get that right. So that tipping point of when I'm no longer contributing, when I'm no longer making the team better, I will finish on that day. But bonus time, man, is like I said earlier, and people might think this is a bluff, but my career from day one has been bonus time. and that's helped me so much. I've never put that pressure on myself. I've never felt like the game owed me something, or, you know, that if I've ever been left out, I've never thought, geez, you know, why me? Why am I being left out? And I think that is a good lesson for anyone, you know, trying to take on a sports career, not even a career, you know, if you sort of playing at any sort of competitive level, I think that's the right approach to have, you know, to realize how lucky you are to be given that chance.
Oh, will he get an overthrow? He does. He might get five. What a way to bring up your first World Cup 100. It's the third in World Cups for a Netherlands batsman. The first for Ryan Tendersgaarte. His first, fourth in One Day Internationals.
I know you don't like talking yourself up, but I ought to ask you more about that innings against England in Nagpur 2011 World Cup. And in fact, for that matter, please bring yourself, try and bring yourself to just tell us about a couple of performances that throughout your career, that will probably bring a smile to your face.
Okay, we'll start with Nagpur, because I had my first overseas job was a mixture of going to Canterbury and playing in New Zealand, and then I joined up with Tasmania. And I'd had a blistering summer in the UK. I'd scored runs, I think, literally in every innings I'd played. You know, I'd smacked every county bowler around, and I then tore my calf, which was also the first injury in my career. And I hadn't picked up a bat, I want to say, from July till maybe October. I then went to New Zealand and done pretty well in their domestic comp. But I went to Tasmania and I was dreadful. I can't explain to you how bad it was. You know, I would have averaged maybe 10. And I mean that is the number I would have averaged. And that was so embarrassing. You know, I've been given this chance to play with George Bailey and Ben Hilfenhaus and Tim Payne. You know, it was really a proper chance to make a name for myself. But I went straight from there to the World Cup. And that game against England was the first game. And I've never watched the innings back, but I'll never forget the first sort of 15 or 20 balls. I couldn't bat. It was that bad. And then I eventually walked across to Collie and like showed my stumps, and Matt Pryor was standing up, and I sort of flicked one inside, you know, between Pryor and the fine leg. And then I just turned into sort of my version of Don Bradman for the next 2 hours. I've never seen the ball so sweetly. So it's just, it was so weird, you know, like dragging the baggage from Australia into the competition. All my preparation, I felt terrible going into that game. And then producing an innings like that, I was immensely proud of that innings. Graham Gooch was the coach of England, the batting coach. And like I said earlier, someone who's been a massive part of my career. So, you know, to do it while he was there was great as well. Ravi, who's one of my good mates on the opposition side, and won the game for them. And a game we really should have won. And of course, Trotty was playing as well. So, you know, it was nice in that sense. And, you know, for the first time to really do it on the international stage is a great feeling. And that is one of my favorite innings. It really is. I've fond memories. And like you said, gets the heart fluttering. I'm not very good at remembering innings, you know, specific innings or even games. But I do vividly remember 2016 when we got promoted, as in Essex got promoted out of Div 2 and sort of the magical run started. I was in the middle on over 100 when we got that final batting point which got us promoted, and I was batting with James Foster. You know, again, the context is someone who's a really good friend, you know, someone who had captained the side a long time and someone who I knew it meant a lot to. And I knew it meant a lot to the club. So again, vividly remember sort of being in the middle, whether it was a single or a double, whatever we got, but crossing that threshold. And that's what sport's all about, you know, that you've achieved this. You set out to achieve this. It was only getting promoted out of Div 2, but, you know, the thing that you started off to achieve and then achieving it, those are the sort of things I remember most vividly.
Essex, once again, have done it. They've won the Bob Willis Trophy.
We haven't spoken about your captaincy because you were pretty good at that as well. But you were happy to give it away, to step aside. You know, it wasn't a sort of an ambition, I get the impression. But what makes a good captain? What made you a good captain?
That's a very difficult question. I think it's foolish not to sort of identify the tangible things that you can look at. So we signed Simon Harmer, who turns out to be pretty much the best county cricketer there's ever been. He'll win you 7 games out of 14 championship games, you know, where you know he's going to get between 8 and 10 wickets. So that is a big thing. Alistair Cook came back in. So basically the things that make the numbers stack up, that make you successful, you know, it's very easy to look past that and say, oh, it was the new coach and the new captain. And we had this great new philosophy where we worked hard, or it was nothing like that. But I on reflection, I think being authentic was my biggest trait, my biggest characteristic that I brought to the team. And I never looked to be something that I wasn't as a captain. I kind of looked at myself and said, what qualities have I got that I can bring into a leadership role that the guys will respond to? I think that's the biggest mistake you can make, is not being authentic, because people see through that straight away. So, you know, I've always been a quite laid back, but I do have a line which I crossed only once in my 4 years as captain, you know, where I thought someone was taking the mickey. So I made sure I stuck to those sort of things. I try to make every day fun. I think that's one of the easily overlooked things of county cricket is that 90% of it is the grind. You know, how do you turn up every day for, what is it, 60 days worth of cricket and try to give your best? It's very easy, you know, to rock up on the sore days and you stay in the change room a little bit longer. You know, you go down 5 minutes before, you look at your watch, you know, you've got an hour and 40 minutes to lunch. So we try to stamp that sort of stuff out. Like, I guess my point is we try to do real practical things to change. So not wishy-washy stuff like we're going to be good blokes, we're going to give our best all the time. It was more the practical implications of, hey, you're a little bit tired today. Don't forget, there's 2 days left for this game. You give everything for the next 2 hours, then we'll chat again. And, you know, you make sure your bowlers then go out half an hour before and that they're on for those 2 hours. And get to lunch and they're knackered and the other team's eight down. You say, buddy, please, two more wickets to go. Then I promise you the next 3 days, I won't look at you. You won't have to touch the ball again. And you know, those sort of practical day-to-day tangible things are the things that I'm most proud of getting right in that short space of time.
Yeah, I love the answer that you almost gave. What makes a good captain? A good team. Because you...
Yeah, I mean, and man, it's funny. So Tom's just taken over and he's a good friend of mine. And, you know, the only advice I gave him in the beginning, I said to him, set your parameters of your leadership now. And when we discuss it at the end of the season, it's not whether we finish first or we finish last. Like, give me five things you want to do. Like, you want to make sure the young guys know that they feel safe at the club. You want to make sure that we review every loss well, that we, when we win, this is how we behave, you know. And then you can come to the end of the summer and you've lost every game. And the first thing people say is, oh, he's a bad captain. Whereas the review of the season actually needs to be on, you know, how good were you as a captain? And I think that's a big misconception in sport and probably magnified most by Premier League football clubs. You know, a team loses four games and you can be pretty sure the manager gets sacked. And it's not an easy thing to do. How do you measure, how do you quantify good leadership or good captaincy? But I'd always be very wary of syncing the two, that a winning a team as a good captain and a losing team as a bad captain. But yeah, you're dead right. The most important thing about captaincy is having good players.
Well, where do you see your future when if you do actually stop playing? Are you looking at coaching or... are you going to do something completely different and spend more time with your family?
Well, firstly, cricket is a cricketer's friend because being home this week, I wish like anything the season was going on for another, just another week would be nice. It's been a tough week. I'd rather be chasing leather around the field for in terms of the workload. But no, it's been so good. And, you know, again, I haven't had this sort of perspective change where I think, oh, my kids are so important. Cricket's not important. But again, I think that's because I've always been good at putting the cricket side into perspective, that it is only a game of cricket. And it really doesn't matter what you're doing apart from, are you giving your best and are you giving yourself the best chance to be the best you can. After cricket, yeah, I'm exploring a bit of coaching at the moment. I'm trying to do my badges. I've actually applied to go on Gary Kirsten's program from January, which will be my first sort of, I've got a level two, which is very basic. But yeah, I want to go into coaching. I've you know, been lucky enough to work with some fantastic coaches. I mean, the best of the best, your good mate Eric, being with him, Mzanzi was eye-opening, you know, someone who really wants to make a difference. Gary as well, we've been super lucky at Essex with Chris Silverwood before he went to England. Mickey Arthur's another one. You know, when you see guys doing their work at the top level, I found that really inspiring and I see similarities in you know, being a cricketer and being a coach, you know, apart from the obvious that you're working in cricket, but, you know, the same sort of goal setting and helping people along and being part of something that does appeal to me. So, yeah, certainly for the near future, I want to try and get involved in coaching.
Stokes in again, steaming in once more, isn't it? And it's been taken! Stokes has done it again! Just when England needed a hero, they found one! Yes, and in the excitement, I should let you know that England won by 189 runs in the end. It was with 8.5 overs to spare.
Give us a brief overview of your thoughts on the future of cricket. Internationally, I'm talking. Are you one of those people that worries about Test cricket?
I don't worry about Test cricket. I think Test cricket's been thrown a lifeline by T20 cricket in the sense that Test cricket is no longer boring. And look, you know, a game drawn out over 5 days that ends in a draw, I don't find boring. But when we talk about the existential crisis, we're talking about, you know, what audience can we appeal to? And we need to be honest and say, slow 5-day cricket, yes, it appeals to a very niche audience. But if you're talking about saving cricket and saving Test cricket, and that's obviously a financial thing, it then needs to appeal to a bigger audience. That's just the way it is. You know, you can be nostalgic about it and say, well, take the T20 money and throw it in Test cricket. No, my opinion is Test cricket needs to save itself. if it's going to be something that continues, it needs to find a way to save itself, to be appealing to however many people you need to make it sustainable. But why I say T20 has thrown a lifeline is I can't think of a boring test series in the last 5 years. And I think it's fine. I think as a product now, it's very good. I think some of the bilateral series will never have the pool needed to make it sustainable. So I think you do need to find a solution to that, whether that is, making sure that England and Australia play each other more and Pakistan and India play each other more and less of Zimbabwe and India playing each other, for example, as harsh as it is and as much as it goes against growing the game, I'm talking about for Test cricket to survive. I don't think that's a positive thing for Test cricket. I don't have the answer to what you do with your Zimbabwe's and your Bangladeshis. And I guess that is the second part of the puzzle of finding how it survives for 12 teams or 11 teams, whatever it is. But I certainly feel that Test cricket's in a better place now than it was 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago. Yeah, I would have been worried about it. But I find Test cricket so exciting. And that filters down to county cricket as well. But one of the key things that county cricket delivers is it makes the England Test team strong. And for that reason, it does serve its purpose and it's worth saving and it's worth finding solutions to save it and to make sure it's good.
Tendo, keep going. You're an inspiration. You really are. And more success to you and to Essex. And enjoy the English winter.
Cheers, mate. Thanks very much. Nice to chat.
You've been listening to Following On, and our exclusive interview with the Essex all-rounder, Ryan Tendascarta. If you missed any of the show or wish to catch up, you can download the podcast from the Following On feed, available on Apple Podcasts, Acast and Spotify. Thanks for listening.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.